Thatcher, 8:06 on this Wednesday. It's October 6th. Currently, we've got 46 degrees here in Park City, 48 degrees in the Heber Valley. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Thomas Giboy. Good morning, Thomas.
Good morning, Leslie. Happy Wednesday. Halfway to the weekend at this point. And yesterday kicked off a kind of a stretch of active weather that we're going to be getting for the rest of this work week into the upcoming weekend. So for today, showers are a likelihood, but the best chance of wet weather really is going to be between now and, say, around 11 o'clock to noon, where the rain chance will be running upwards of around 80%. We have seen a decent amount of wet weather making its way up the mountains into the Heber Valley, so we'll be watching that as we go throughout the next couple of hours. It's also going to be a relatively cool day in Park City, so even though our temperatures are sitting in the 40s now, we're only going to see a daytime high of 61 degrees, so it is going to be cooler compared to what we saw yesterday. And outside of any wet weather, we're going to be looking at mostly cloudy skies. So even though the rain chance will be going down by the time we get into the afternoon, we'll still be keeping about a 1 in 3 chance for wet weather as we go from late this afternoon through the overnight hours tonight. And we also could see a few isolated thunderstorms embedded in that as well, as an overnight low tonight drops into the middle 40s. For our Thursday, another system will be moving in from our west, so showers will be likely once again, but rain chance won't be quite as high compared to what we find today. It's about a 2 in 3 rain chance at 60% from Thursday afternoon into Thursday night. Tomorrow we'll see a daytime high of 63 degrees, and then the overnight low Thursday night into Friday morning drops back into the middle 40s. Then as we go into Friday, what we'll be watching is a system coming in from the Pacific Northwest, and this is going to pack a punch with a pretty good rain chance really across the entire state, but a very significant rain chance in Park City at 90% from Friday night into Saturday, where we're going to be keeping that high rain chance, and the temperature will also dial back as well. On Friday, a daytime high of 54 degrees. Friday night, the overnight low at 38. And then on Saturday, we're only going to see daytime highs in the middle 40. So it is going to be a chilly day for our Saturday. And if the moisture is able to hold on long enough, there is a chance that we could see rain and maybe a little bit of snow mixed in Saturday night, with an overnight low dropping close to freezing, but the chance of seeing any accumulation very, very low, just because of the ground going to be on the warmer side and the snow level might be just above what we would see in Park City. But on Sunday, we're looking at a mostly dry sky. That should be a relatively calm day with a daytime high of 53 degrees. Then another system will be moving in for the early stages of the week, and that's going to help increase the chance of rain once again for Columbus Day into Monday with a daytime high of 51 degrees. Then on Monday night, it turns cold again with an overnight low near freezing. Then rain and snow showers are going to be a possibility on Tuesday with daytime highs in the lower and middle 40s.
Okay. Hey, Thomas, thank you.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
KPCW News Time now, 8:08. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, Wasatch County Superintendent Paul Sett once again canceling just the afternoon before he was scheduled this morning. Instead, we'll be talking with Park City Municipal Utilities Director Clint McAfee and Sally Elliott from Friends of Ski Mountain Mining History. We'll be talking about the reopening of the Spiro Tunnel, both from the practical and historical perspectives. Then Park City Manager Matt Dias and Environmental Sustainability Project Manager Celia Peterson with a preview of this week's City Council meeting, including the decarbonization of buildings. For the final report of the growing season, Summit Community Garden Director Natalie McHale with a gardens update. And finally, National Geographic photographer Amy Vitale talking about her work around the world of endangered species and the presentations that she'll be making at the opening of the Eccles main stage on Saturday night. Stay tuned. And stay tuned. Coming up right after the local news hour on The Mountain Life, today's guests include Dr. Paul Mariak, a new primary care provider at the University of Utah Health Redstone Clinic. And then a conversation with Sarah Cummings and Danny Connolly, both locals, have just finished the St. George Marathon. While they took the same path on Saturday, their journeys to the finish line, very different. That's all coming up right after the local news hour on The Mountain Life at 9:06. Taking a look at local news now, Summit County Health Director Dr. Phil Bondurant reporting that the county has been shifted back to a moderate transmission status. The Summit County Health Board heard that and other good news during the COVID-19 update at its regular meeting Monday, but Bondurant said that there are some areas of concern. KPCW's Rick Bruff has more.
Phil Bondurant told the Health Board the COVID numbers are trending in the direction they want. The county has seen a case decline in the past 2 weeks and a positivity rate below 5%. He did report that last week there were two bumps showing case increases, but he said that was likely due to the timing of reports from the lab. Bondurant said he thinks the counts will return to a plateau and then a decline. Bondurant said the state is also reporting better news.
You know, the state as a whole is in incidence decline, which is interesting. We're keeping a close eye on that. Governor Cox said last week that he believes that the state as a whole is on the backside of the Delta surge, which we keep our fingers crossed that he's accurate. And as we move indoors, because the weather is now cold, we'll keep an eye on that conversation.
Summit County recently recorded the county's 18th death, a female between 65 and 85 years old. Most of Summit County's cases are people 25 to 64 years old. Bondurant added that state hospitalizations have also dropped, but the number is still higher than they'd like. Summit County has not yet hit a threshold to require a mask mandate in the county schools. An order of constraint applied to elementary, junior high, and middle schools would call for masks if a 2% 14-day positivity rate appears in a campus population of students, teachers, and staff.
I think right now Ecker Middle School is reporting 7 cases over the last 14 days, which is about a 0.89% of their school population. So halfway there. But that is the highest number. Every other school of the schools that we're monitoring are 4 cases or below. So the schools are still doing well. You can see that over the last 14 days, the 5 to 10 year olds, we've had about 15 cases, 11 to 13 year olds, 7, and 14 to 17, 2 cases. Now, this isn't saying these were in school. These are just school-aged kids. We're still seeing that the majority of the exposures that are coming out of that population, what we'll say 5 to 18, are occurring outside of schools, at least in Summit County.
Part City Hospital CEO Lori Weston said the hospital has seen 4 to 6 COVID cases a day. While the COVID caseload had recently been crowding out other patients, Weston said they are starting to undertake a few more surgeries every week. Last month, hospital authorities reported they had been seeing cases of COVID patients who were aggressive and violent, along with visitors refusing to obey hospital rules about masks and distancing. Weston said they are seeing those cases 2 or 3 times a week. She added that hospital staff are feeling the stress.
We've lost a lot of nurses. We have 2 more ICU nurses that are actually leaving in the next couple of weeks that are going to take more of a clinic type of role where they're not doing face-to-face patient care and just in the situation anymore. They don't feel safe.
On a related topic, Health Board Chairman Chris Cherniak asked if the county is working with the Sundance Film Festival on COVID protocols.
I'm hearing from folks around town that I chat with that they have concerns and questions about how you're going to make this work at multiple venues with multiple points of ingress and egress to events and activities, and how you're going to enforce that.
Bondurant said he is meeting with Sundance organizers weekly. He said he can't disclose some details of what the festival is planning. However, Sundance recently announced that all those attending in-person events at the 2022 festival must have proof of vaccination. Attendees must also wear masks at all times indoors or while in wait lines, tents, restrooms, or other temporary structures. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
And a reminder that Summit County Health Department is offering free COVID-19 drive-through rapid testing at each of its 3 locations. Testing is available Monday, Tuesdays, and Fridays between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. Appointments are not required. In Park City, the testing site located at 650 Round Valley Drive, that's located near the hospital. In Camas, the tests are being given at 110 North Main Street, and in Colville, available at North 50th East Street. News time, 8:15. Well, even though now abandoned from its mining activities, the Spiro Tunnel produces a constant flow of water from the tunnel and is a substantial water source for Park City. Yesterday, Park City reopened the tunnel after several years of work. On the phone with more details, I have Municipal Utilities Director Clint McAfee, and in the studio is Sally Elliott from Friends of Ski Mountain Mining History. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Clint, the Spiro Tunnel, important from both from very practical water sources that it provides, but it also has an important history to Park City. So let's just start with you. Spiro Tunnel provides how much of the city's water supply?
Yeah, so the Spiro Tunnel alone provides
up to about 30% of our total water supply for the city. It's an important water supply. It flows right out above the golf course, so it feeds the municipal golf course, the country club golf course, snowmaking for Vail. It provides creek flow, and it will also provide water for drinking water once the Three Kings Water Treatment Plant is constructed. And before we demolished the Spiro Water Treatment Plant, the Spiro water was treated at that facility and used for drinking water.
Yeah, so yesterday we saw, for those who got to walk back, some 3,000 to 4,000 gallons of water a minute flowing. This in the middle of a drought. So how much does that source fluctuate? I mean, or is it pretty consistent year round?
Yeah, it's a great question. It fluctuates a lot, actually, and it might be flowing a little bit less. We're probably at the lowest point we've ever seen at this point. Just because of the dry soil moisture conditions last year. And then, you know, just kind of the average snowpack. But it can range from about 3,000 gallons a minute all the way up to 7,000 gallons a minute. So that's about 4.5 million gallons a day to just about 10 million gallons a day. And one thing to note about that source is you can't shut it off. And so that's why this project was so important. You know, there's no valve to turn the mountain off, you know, from producing water. So this first 400 feet was at risk of collapsing. And there's a pipe that conveys the water from 400 feet into the tunnel out to the treatment plant. And it was also collapsing. And so, you know, you can imagine all that water being backed up if it should collapse. It's going to come out somewhere, and it would have been a catastrophe. And that was one of the main reasons we selected this portion of the tunnel to do first, and why it was so critical to protecting this water source.
Yeah, it looked like there were two pipes. Only one of those is being used, though?
So in the tunnel, there's a pipe that, you know, when you're standing there at 400, as everyone saw last night, there's a pipe that runs kind of above the tracks. That runs all the way back to what we call the bulkhead at 13,500 feet, and that was a previous attempt back in the 80s to isolate some clean water out of that tunnel. It was unsuccessful because really the metals are coming from most parts of the tunnel. But that pipe conveys water from all the way back in the tunnel. And then the ditch flow that you can see running along the ground of the tunnel is the bulk of the flow. So there's about 900 gallons a minute coming out of the pipe, and then right around 2,000 gallons a minute coming off the tunnel floor.
Okay, so you said that the treatment plant has been dismantled as we're rebuilding the new one, so that water just running into the golf course ponds and making its way downstream?
Yeah, and we're also, so it's right now, we're still using it for golf course irrigation, still making water, and it's providing water for the creek. That's another reason this project has been so tough, because when we demolish the plant and we're redoing the Spiro Tunnel, we have to continue to serve drinking water to the community. So over the years, we've had to augment the capacity of Quinn's Water Treatment Plant. We've rebuilt the Park Meadows Well for the Creekside Water Treatment Plant. And we've done a few other things like interconnects with the basin water providers to help provide water during this time that this facilities being constructed.
So only the first 400 feet of the tunnel needed to be rehabilitated?
No, it's the most critical. It was the worst condition and the highest risk, and really the highest consequence of failure if it were to fail. We Public Utilities Department for the city manage that. We maintain that tunnel back to about 14,000 feet. And there's various sections along the tunnel that also need repair. But to get to those, we needed to secure and the first 400 feet to make it safe to enter those back parts. And we keep it open that deep because there's a water-bearing formation. It's called the Weber Quartzite. So most of the water is actually originating about 3 miles back into the mountain. And so... You know, the tunnels act basically like a horizontal well you know, they're drilled at a slight slope so the water can drain out, but they collect water. It's kind of an under drain for the mountains, and most of that water is produced deep into the mine.
All right.
And so we will be focusing on those other sections in the future.
This was a three-phase project, is my understanding, and we're done now with phase two. How much have we spent so far, and how much more do we still have to spend?
So the first 400 included the piping, all the work that folks saw last night, and some control structures. It was probably, you know, the most infrastructure intensive. That was about $4 million. We're still evaluating what to do with the other two sections, but I imagine they'll be close, if not less, than what we spent on the first 400. And again, it's important to note just how valuable this water source is to the community. You know, 30% of our water supply, and, you know, when we're talking about water supply for the entire Park City area, Snyderville Basin included, you know, Park City is a part of a group called the Western Summit County Project, and we are evaluating alternatives to bring in additional water supply if we run out. And those projects are well over $100 million, you know, probably approaching a couple hundred million dollars right now, to bring in about what the Spiro Tunnel makes. And so, you know, it makes sense for us to spend this money and secure this water supply.
Okay. I'm going to turn this over to Sally Elliott. Again, the Friends of the Ski Mountain Mining History Group invited your members to this historic day. Why was your group excited about the reopening of Spiro Tunnel?
Well, because it's a unique and integral part of everything else we're doing. Our stated goal was to preserve 10 prominent mining sites that we identified very early, 6 years ago when we founded the group, so that we could stabilize these structures for the future. We want our kids and grandkids to be able to see the structures, and we want to be able to tell the stories with the structures in place as illustrations. People who hike in the summer and bike up on the mountains love to see those pieces of our history, and they love to hear the stories about it. So
there's a lot of history to Spiro Tunnel. Maybe give us the Reader's Digest version here. It was a miner, Solon Spiro, who couldn't get to his silver in the mountain because there was too much water, huh?
That's right. You dig a hole, a deep hole, and it fills up with water, and we call that a well. Well, what are you going to do with the water at the bottom if you need to be in the bottom working? So Solon decided that in order to drain his Bogan shaft, which is right in the middle of Claim Jumper Run, you know where the big ore bin is on Claim Jumper? Right in the middle of that run is a very deep, 1,800-foot deep shaft. And it filled with water, and he wasn't able to mine that location. So he decided the only thing to do was dig a deep tunnel and let the water come out through the tunnel by gravity flow. And it turned out to be financially very viable for him.
All right. And how did the Friends help with this project? I mean,
well, we didn't do any of the digging. We didn't put any of the shotcrete in place. We didn't fund any of the Spiro Tunnel site. What we did do was work with Alan Long, who's the president of the HOA at Silver Star. And Alan is also a member of our Friends of Ski Mountain Mining History Committee. He has restored the Ivers Tunnel as a real estate office, and it's a fascinating place because you can walk in that real estate office and see a big panel of glass where he has opened up the Ivers Tunnel and cleaned it up, and it's just very much a part of the real estate operation there. So we're very grateful to Alan Long. He raised the money through historic district grants, and Friends of Ski Mountain Mining History helped to fund the restoration of the coal hopper and the ore bin down at the entrance to Silver Star. And then Alan designed some plaques to explain the history of the place. And of course, Roy Murphy, who was the major developer of Silver Star many years ago, had the vision of interpreting the history as well. And Roy was my co-founder of Friends of Ski Mountain Mining History. He got busy and Donald Rohl took his place, and it's been a fine, phenomenal team of people who are retired professionals who just want to be a part of the effort. So Rory started the vision, Alan has continued it, and then Marianne Cohn and I designed the text for the plaques that are outside, and Dalton Gackle and at the museum pulled the photos for us to use, and Aiden Lilly, who is the historic district planner at Park City in the planning office, put them all together and had the plaques produced. They're gorgeous. I'm fascinated.
Yeah. So, Clint, now that the tunnel is safe and lighted, will you let the Friends or maybe the Park City Museum offer tours in the future?
My answer to that is no. You know, at the end of the day, it's still a water source. We need to treat it as such. You know, we don't, we hold those sacred and protect, you know, those, and we typically don't let people in. And in addition to that, you know, we're going to continue the work deeper into the mine, and so it's really not going to be suitable for, you know, public to access. We're going to be staging equipment in the area that was viewed last night. So it, you know, it's pristine right now, but, you know, it'll return kind of to a beehive of activity inside the tunnel, so it won't have the impact that this project did outside of the tunnel. But yeah, we'll probably go back to the what it was before, which is you know, generally just open to contractors and staff.
So, Sally, I mean, that was historic in that sense last night. It's really a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to walk back there.
One-shot deal. One of the things we're doing is working in the Thames Tunnel, which has been clogged. And we're trying to close that shaft but leave air, because that tunnel connects directly to the Thames shaft. So we're going to be working with Clint to provide an air source to the far end of that tunnel. And, of course, on the 14th of October at 9 o'clock in the morning, we're having a fundraiser to allow people to watch and learn about the raising of the Daily West. So we'll be talking about that next week.
Okay. Sally, Clint, anything else you wanted to add?
I just want to say thanks for everyone showing up last night. It was a great turnout. Linda Jager and her team did an amazing job promoting the event and calling attention to it. And then just thanks to my team. This was a really complicated and unusual project for us. And so we're kind of gaining that skill set in our team, and my team, Public Utilities team, did a great job.
Okay. Do you think there might have been 300 or 400 people there?
I'm not good at I kept hearing people say a couple hundred. So yeah, it was a great turnout.
Big group.
Okay, Clint, Sally Elliott, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Leslie.
You're listening to Local News Hour here on KPCW. News time now, 8:30. KPCW News Time now, 8:32. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, the Park City Council meets in work session tomorrow starting at 4:30 to hear the recommendations from the Walking and Biking Liaison Committee, known as WALK, and a discussion on how to decarbonize buildings. In the studio with details, Park City Manager Matt Dias. On the phone with me, I have Environmental Sustainability Project Manager Celia Peterson. Good morning.
How are you?
I'm doing great, thanks. Well, we'll start with you, Matt.
Sure.
We had heard yesterday that WALK 2.0 has decided to move forward with getting this so-called Dance to Jans tunnel completed, but it's going to take more money than we have left over from the bond back in 2017. So there's this, or 2000, it was a while ago when the bond was completed, 14 years ago. But it does this make sense now that the Arts and Culture District at this point is on the back burner?
Well, we think it continues to make sense, and I don't think a pursuit of the tunnel necessarily precludes additional improvements in the arts and cultural district area, and I don't think the WALK committee felt that way either. You know, to take a step back, I think we have a very, very strong history, in fact, of, you know, pursuing a comprehensive list of capital projects that are very, very important to town. All sorts of trails and pathways and tunnels and crosswalks that people are familiar with and are beloved, such as the Bonanza Tunnel, the Comstock Tunnel. And so, you know, we don't necessarily feel that these are mutually exclusive long term, but that area in the middle of town, that sort of light industrial area, we realize, the walk committee realizes, that we're going to have to look at that when we're looking at the 2.0 version or what's to come next, about how we improve, make some of those connections safer. But the tunnel that we're talking about, I guess, you know, for lack of a better word, the reason it's been put off is it's extremely complicated. It's perhaps at our most congested, most heavily utilized intersection in our entire community, and we just put the community through a long-term disruption on 248 with regard to construction and water lines and repaving. And then, you know, what you've alluded to is it's also expensive. We think we can come up with a financial plan. We just need a little bit of time, and it's been great to reconvene this group of stakeholders. They have a lot of knowledge. They did a lot of work in the past. We've done walking tours with them. It's been a wonderful exercise, and now they get the opportunity to come back and chat with council and report in.
Okay. Can you kind of give us an update here? I mean, what is the status of the Arts and Culture District? I mean, are we waiting for election results just to see what perhaps a new council wants to do here, or?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think obviously we felt that we needed to take a quality step back and sort of reevaluate where we were. The soils repository that we were planning in town was a necessary step to accelerating any construction activities there. And so, you know, we're working right now on evaluating soil hauling cost and other aspects if the repository won't be in town. And so, you know, there's just some sort of quality construction work happening behind the scenes about evaluating engineering necessary next steps before we can make some policy decisions.
Okay. Let's see. We're still waiting for Celia to connect, and unfortunately I don't have her cell phone number to...
I mean, I'm welcome to skip ahead and then come back to it too,
okay,
if you'd like.
Let's talk a little bit about the regular meeting, a budget update. How do things look now through August?
I probably sound like a broken record, and you know, just very, very fortunate to be in here again, reporting that we had, you know, the strongest July we've ever had as a community with regard to sales tax. I do get some criticism when I talk about sales tax, because that's but one measure of a healthy community, but it is certainly an important measure in terms of our economic well-being. And so we were up 17% from July 20. So obviously not the COVID year, but the pre-year. And so the other bright news on the horizon is that our TRT has rebounded, and that was also up almost over 10% over the previous July. So very, very strong sales tax numbers. It looks like the lodging tax has rebounded. By all means, the economy is roaring, but, you know, we understand that that's but one measure of the overall health of a community. There are, of course, impacts that we're constantly mitigating that are associated with that.
Yeah. We still have more than $500,000 in the American Rescue Plan money. So what's the plan for that?
Great question. So, well, hopefully we've got more coming on the way. We've got several installments of funding, and our staff will be returning to council with a plan of reimbursing expenses for the first $500,000 that have already been expended by the municipality. So these are things like additional safety measures and precautions, PPE materials and supplies, additional signage, some of the leave programs, excuse me, for our workforce. If someone came down with COVID-19 or had to be quarantined and they were out of sick time. So there's a bunch of reimbursement work that we'll be doing to catch up on.
Okay. The council will also consider the winter special event calendar. One of the biggest, I guess, crushes will be the FIS World Cup at Deer Valley. That's been moved up several weeks, for January 12th to 14th. Couple of obstacles there, of course, trying to keep it off of Sundance and also off the Martin Luther King holiday, but still needing to get it in before the 2022 Olympics. So are we asking too much here to try and squeeze that in the week before Sundance?
Well, I mean, you know, you raise sort of the quintessential question, which is this is all about balance. And so what staff's attempting to do here for both the community, the city council, and our media outlets and our residents and our businesses is signal about the winter events season ahead. And so this report is fairly comprehensive, as you noted. It lists the events throughout the winter. And it will be a busy season. It is undoubtedly, it may be our busiest season ever. To top that off, we have obviously the 20th anniversary of our own Salt Lake Olympic Games, which we'll be celebrating and commemorating around the state and here in Park City, on top of the Olympic Games itself, Sundance, FIS. And so, you know, that decision about whether we're slipping things in too early or it's too activated, that would obviously be a policy decision by the mayor and the council and the community. But we are just sort of signaling and giving a heads up to folks of what to expect, and that we do want feedback along the way. And that's why we're creating this opportunity for a conversation and signaling to the community ahead of time about what's to come.
And then what's the thinking now about Sundance? With it going hybrid, should we expect the crush of the masses there to also lower?
Well, you know, I don't know if I necessarily want to speculate. I mean, I have my personal opinions that I think the hybrid festival will be obviously somewhat different and will change over time, much like most things post-COVID. But we do anticipate a very successful festival here, a high level of visitation. But, you know, perhaps we should have Sundance report on that and sort of run us through what they think the hybrid festival will be like. But we're excited. We're planning behind the scenes with law enforcement, transit, parking, our communications team. And we're excited to bring the festival back this year.
Yeah. Also, later on in the agenda is a discussion with regard to the Triple Crown Agreement. Again, another special event. It sounds like everyone's pretty much done with this. It does have like a $2 million economic impact, though.
It does, and I think we don't know if everyone's sort of done with this, to use your statement, but this is the last year of a contract that was extended due to COVID-19. We felt that, City Council and the mayor felt that we wanted to meet our obligations contractually, so we extended the contract for a year that was disrupted because of COVID. And Triple Crown really wants to know, to your point, about their future here in Park City. You know, they do go back a long way. You know, believe it or not, I was looking at the notes and the history. They go all the way back to 2003, and this was an initiative, I believe, with Summit County, Park City, the Chamber of Commerce, the Lodging Association, Retail Association, Restaurant Association, sort of joined together to bring this tournament here to activate the economy during the summer and slower times of the year. But that was a long time ago. And so council needs to have a conversation about the level of outreach we're asking, what type of outreach they would like us to conduct based upon any future contract renewals prior to making their decision.
Okay, let's move on to, at 5 o'clock, then back in the middle of the agenda, a discussion regarding decarbonizing buildings. On the phone with us, I've got Celia Peterson, who is the city's environmental sustainability project manager. So define, Celia, what that even means.
Hi, good morning, Leslie. So if you look at our community-wide carbon footprint, our buildings account for almost 60% of Park City's emissions. And with our goal to be net zero carbon by 2030, we've got our work cut out for ourselves as a community. If you look at other communities across the United States, they're more like 30 to 40%. So our buildings have a really big impact. And so that was kind of the conception of this whole project. We approached Utah Clean Energy to jointly apply for some funding, and were awarded that from the Partners for Places grant, and then also Utah Clean Energy supplemented that with climate fund funding from the Park City Community Foundation. And for the past 15 months, we've been working with them. We organized about 9 months of expert workshops. We've got a lot of building experts in the building industry in Park City, and we wanted to collect people together to really think about how we could approach our building sector. And we had 9 months of meetings with our expert groups and broke ourselves into 4 different work groups to really tackle different parts of the building sector. So our work groups broke up into looking at existing buildings, what type of retrofit strategies we could take on, and then also new construction. I mean, the best building built, or the most efficient building is one that will be designed to be highly efficient. And then the other two are more supporting work groups. How are we going to finance all of these projects? Our finance group looked at several strategies. And then also, how can we just pull the market forward? Business and community leader engagement and recognition was our 4th work group. And out of those came 10 different strategies that all work together to help us decarbonize our built environment as we move towards 2030.
Yeah, so what
so
was...
our council meeting tomorrow will be... I was just going to follow up with our council meeting tomorrow. It's just introducing council to the suite of strategies just to get their general feedback and on our approach to this and any advice on what we should prioritize or slow down on. So that's what tomorrow is all about.
All right. So what's the total amount of grant money that you had to work with?
It was $100,000. So we got 75 from Partners for Places, and then the Community Foundation matched half of that.
All right. Well, so for those who have solar panels on their homes, have they already met the decarbonization?
It depends on how much energy they're using. So when it comes to a zero energy building, what the definition of that would be is that 100% of your net energy use needs to be produced on site. And that is one pathway forward. That being said, you've talked with Luke about the developments that we're having around renewable energy just to supply all of the electricity that comes to Park City with renewable sources. So that's another strategy, but again, if we don't have to build extra, efficiency is always the first and foremost way to go, is to really look at ways that we can build our new buildings to be as highly efficient as possible, but then also looking at retrofits for existing buildings. And there's already some existing financial mechanisms to help support that, and we're looking at some new ones as well.
So what are we talking about in terms of retrofits? New windows, new furnaces?
Well, first of all, yep, you're along the right lines. First and foremost, though, we just need to target which buildings are poor performers that need a little bit of help. So several of the strategies really focus on just transparency and disclosure. So just trying to help building owners understand what their energy profile looks like, and then that's the way that you tackle, like, all right, this is out of whack in this part of your energy profile, so let's work on retrofitting your HVAC system, or maybe it is your windows. Every building is different and how it performs is different. So this is not the least complicated project of all time, but it's something we've got to do, and so we're starting early.
Okay. Matt, Celia, anything else you wanted to add?
I do have one more thing to add. I just wanted to make sure that the community knew that tonight at 7 p.m. we will be having another coffee with council, and this evening it's Councilmember Joyce and Mayor Bierman at 7 p.m. It's a virtual exercise, and I know it says coffee with council. I've seen some funny memes out there already that people better have their decaf ready or their decaffeinated tea, but a great opportunity to interact directly with a council member and the mayor, 7 p.m. It's virtual. People can do that at home this evening.
Okay. Matt, Celia, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time now, 8:46. Well, with the growing season now behind us, the Summit Community Gardens is being put to bed for the winter, but the garden still has some public events coming up. In the studio with details, I have Garden Director Natalie McCown. Good morning.
Good morning.
So first, I guess for those who have a garden plot, now is the time to clean it up.
Oh, certainly. Yeah, especially with this rain, it makes pulling all those plants and weeds just a tad bit easier. So definitely a good time to get out there.
Okay. And you're also taking reservations then for next year?
Yep, certainly. If you go on our website, it's titled as a wait list. But if you put your name on your wait list by November 30th, all of our current plot renters will let us know if they are coming back for the 2022 season. So we should know early January 2022 if a plot is open for you.
Oh, okay. As I mentioned, we still have some events happening. First up is at the it's called the end of the year event. That's happening October 23rd, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. So what's happening there?
Yeah, so that's just our day between 10 and 2. We get all of our current plot renters together and anyone who wants to learn more about winterizing your garden. We have a lot of guest visitors. John, who sells biochar, which is a new amendment that people are adding to their soil that lasts a lifetime. So we have him there providing that. And we teach workshops about garlic planting, tulip planting, how to winterize your garden, best compost amendments to add. So it's something for everyone, but it's just a way to add some energy into the garden, get everyone there together to get their garden cleaned up for next year.
Okay, so these classes, are they happening at specific times or just kind of?
They'll be on our website once we get those listed. We're still waiting on finalizing those times with a few of our visitors. But if you show up, I'm always there and happy to answer your questions.
All right, do you need to register for that?
Nope, just come on down.
Okay, and then for folks looking for something a bit different from Main Street, you're also planning Halloween in the Garden on October 31st. This is happening from 4 to 6 p.m.?
Yep. So last year was our first year doing that, and it was our way to address families looking for ways to have a COVID-safe Halloween, so masks were required. I'm not sure we'll do that this year, just depending on the county guidelines. But we set it up as a one-way maze, so that way kids are all moving one direction. You don't worry about people intermingling too much. Families are spaced out. We have a lot of community partners there providing workstations and craft stations. So lots to do, but always plenty of candy for everyone.
Okay. You are asking people to RSVP to that?
Yes, that one will be RSVP on our website.
Okay. Anything else you need to let us know
about? That is it. Thanks for having us.
Okay, Natalie, thank you. KPCW News Time now, 8:49. The opening of the Park City Eccles Center for the Performing Arts happens this Saturday night with photographer and filmmaker Amy Vitale. She joins me now on the phone. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning.
So start by telling us just a little bit about your work. It sounds like you've focused on diminishing wildlife, but you've also covered war as well.
Yes, and you know, maybe I'll even reframe it a little bit and say that it's kind of a journey around the world over the last 25 years, from covering conflict to, you know, this situation where we are facing a lot of species going extinct, and it is that. But I've really focused on finding these stories of really the impossible, of people, remarkable people, the resilience, and finding solutions. So it's really a story of hope and of solutions.
So give us an idea of what to expect then on Saturday night.
Sure. Well, I'll dig into some of the stories I've worked on for really many, many years. One of the stories would be the, you know, how I began getting into covering wildlife and issues of extinction began with the northern white rhino. And I started following this story back in 2009 when they were moving four of them from a zoo in the Czech Republic all the way back to Kenya in this last-ditch effort to save the whole species. And that is really the catalyst for my whole search for finding, you know, what do we do with this? Because it was so hopeless when I began to realize, most recently in 2018, that Sudan passed away. He was the last male northern white rhino, and it was just this wake up call, I believe, for a lot of people to understand that this is, you know, these species that have existed for millions of years. That was the end. And so I began to really, actually much earlier than that, look for stories where people were changing the trajectory. And that led me to stories like Rattetti Elephant Sanctuary, where a community on their own initiative, a community with very little, you know, political power, resources, are doing the impossible now, and they are rescuing orphaned elephants and sending them back to the wild. And it's not just this story about how they are relating to wildlife, but also how they're relating to one another. It's the first sanctuary that hires indigenous women to be elephant keepers, and it's changing how the whole landscape is restoring itself. And so there's that. I've also covered the story of pandas that were also endangered, and now their numbers are growing in the wild, and there's just a remarkable story there. There's a lot of joy in the stories, and it's not, you know, it's not just joy. There's challenges, but I really kind of dig into some of the stories that I think we all need to hear right now.
Yeah, so when you go out to do the work, I mean, do you bring a writer with you, or is that... You do it all. I mean, your photographs almost, you know, pictures are worth a thousand words, huh?
Well, I do. You know, most of my work I've done on my own. I've also made, I've been doing films now, and in those cases, the team is usually bigger. It's still a small footprint. It's usually about three of us. But all of these stories from covering, you know, Afghanistan, all the way up until today, usually those stories are just, I find going out on my own really, really, it's actually a beautiful way to go and engage with the world. And I've, you know, I think that's one other kind of takeaway is that it, I feel like sometimes if you only turn on the news and hear the headlines, you miss a lot of the humanity. And there's great humanity all over the world. And I've really been fortunate to witness that. And that's kind of my big message for people right now.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm guessing the photographs get published in National Geographic. I'm guessing the films are played back there on the Nat Geo station. And then also getting word out, doing this similar presentations across the country?
Yes, I'm doing these. And actually, my film, you know, that I just did a, for example, of online streaming of my film and was able to raise $250,000 for the Elephant Sanctuary. And a lot of my work is really just showing people that it, as an individual, we can do so much. And, you know, I do have this extraordinary platform of National Geographic, but I do also, you know, work on a really small, you know, small scale, but in the world we live in, we can all do that. But I am right now on going out and giving talks all over.
Is this something that the whole family will enjoy?
Absolutely. This is for everyone. And I think it's a story for children most of all.
Okay. And as you mentioned, you have worked all over the world. Any particular place that has stood out for you?
Every single story has, I mean, I spend years on every story I work on, but I think that's the thing I've discovered is that every place, if you dig a little bit and spend more time, you start to connect and build those relationships. And so they're all very special to me.
And then in terms of, I mean, you had mentioned that you're traveling, doing this presentation now. What's next for you?
I'm actually headed back to Kenya in just a few days, and I'll be continuing the work on this effort to save the northern white rhinos from extinction. And I just keep going back to the same places because stories unfold in beautiful ways over time.
Okay. Amy Vitale will be the opening presenter at the Park City Eccles Center this Saturday night. Showtime is 7 p.m. Tickets are online at parkcityinstitute.org or contact the box office 435-655-3114. Amy, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you so much.
Well, if some people expected bland fall colors to follow the drought over the summer, the trees had other plans. KPCW's Ben Lassiter has input from a local horticulturist on the environmental factors to thank for this year's stunning display.
To the delight of Wasatch Back leaf peepers, the leaves on various trees changed to vibrant colors over the past couple of weeks. During hikes, runs, or mountain bike rides, or just viewed out of car windows, locals are loving the mountainside tapestries. Megan Lewis is an associate professor for the Utah State University Extension in Summit and Wasatch Counties. While changing leaves aren't an exact science, she says the recent rains could have come at a perfect time to make the colors really pop this year.
So my first guess is that we had that late, really heavy rainfall in August, and I'm wondering if that kind of energized the trees a little bit and helped them to have those brighter colors.
Leaves change in fall when the days get shorter. When the trees sense the change in season, it's an automatic trigger to pigmentation changes in the leaves. Later, when the leaves die and drop off, the trees are able to conserve nutrients. Lewis says the color variation that occurs from year to year depends on how long the days last, combined with overnight temperatures. Along with the rain, this year's warm, sunny days and cool nights were especially conducive to bringing out the colors.
We also haven't had our traditional really early frost this year either. So if we have an early frost, that can really damage the leaves and cause them to turn brown early. So because we had a later frost, we've really been able to drag out this color with those bright pinks, reds, and purples.
Lewis says the most noticeable change happens with the departure of chloroplast, which is what makes the leaves green during the warm months. That's when carotenoids, which are present year-round but masked by the dominant green color, bring out a golden yellow hue. The stark yellow is especially visible in aspens. Maples and dogwoods get a new reddish pigment from anthocyanins with the onset of cold weather. From afar, the combinations of these colors can look diverse and complicated. Aside from how much daylight individual trees receive, their levels of water and nutrient intake impact how much chloroplast they carry. Now that there have been some frosts, the period of most extreme color is past. Lewis says the trees are now transitioning into winter survival mode.
Just as part of the cycle, trees, they create these cells where the leaf connects to the branch, and they basically break off their own leaves just to protect themselves, because if those leaves are staying on the tree for too long, then they can pull a lot of nutrients from the tree. But what we want to do is push all of those nutrients down into the roots. So they're basically protecting themselves. It really wouldn't benefit the tree to have the leaves on any longer.
Lewis teaches monthly classes based on USU research, which are mostly free and available to the public. To find out more, visit extension.usu.edu. Ben Lassiter, KPCW News.
And a small brush fire that started in Pinyon Canyon with smoke visible from Oakley is still burning, but under control and not threatening any structures. As of midday Tuesday, two South Summit Fire Department crews were working on the fire in the right fork of Pinyon Canyon above Oakley. South Summit Fire Commissioner Kent Levitt said the fire has burned about 2 acres and didn't grow much. Over Tuesday night, it is considered under control. Helicopter assistance was supposed to come in later yesterday. The fire did not start from a controlled burn and is an area only accessible by foot. Fire officials are suspecting that it may have been started by a hunter, but they're not sure. Coming up now on 9 o'clock, stay tuned for NPR's Morning Edition. You've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW Park City.